You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Welcome to the show, Amy. It's great to have you on.
Delighted to be here.
You've got a really interesting background. You spent a lot of years at some very large organizations like Microsoft and HP, and you weren't necessarily in what you might think of as like traditional, typical brand roles. Like, what was the first time in your career where you really started to get your hands on brand with a B, if you will?
Brand with a big B. I had little minor forays into it, I suppose, at Microsoft and HP, but I really started diving in when I was working for Polycom. Polycom was its own company, and I had actually, we were doing a big rebrand shortly after I was named CMO, and we were ready to roll it out, and Polycom was acquired. So I was about ready to roll it out, and it's like, oh, hello, we're being acquired by Plantronics. And so, great, I had done all of this work. It was the first time I'd really gotten, and nobody ever saw the light of day. So then when Plantronics bought Polycom, we had to rename the company. We had to rebrand this combined company to equal size companies. So all of the standard like lead horse, reverse lead horse, put them together and you come up with Polytronics or Plancom, or nothing was really going to work. And so that combined company rebranded as Poly, and it was an amazing adventure.
So I think most of us, maybe above a certain age, maybe I'm trying to think above 25, probably all recognize the Polycom brand, but think about it in a narrow form, right? Just it was a precursor to video, right? When it was just voice. But what else was in that business? So outside of what we typically think of as Polycom, what were the sort of the other parts of that business?
So Polycom had kind of the phones piece, but it also did video. So when I joined Polycom, in fact, in my office, as was in everybody's office, you know, back when we used to go to the office, but we all had video screens, and so we did video meetings all the time. This is before Zoom even existed, right? So the video was a big part of the company, but it was expensive. It was a complicated install. It was on-premises servers. Like, this sounds like prehistoric times now to talk about it, but we were really early advocates that you could actually work from anywhere. So that was a big part of Polycom. Of course, the conference phones were, Polycom basically invented the conference phone. And that was a great thing. Part of the problem was that they never broke. So you can still go into somebody's conference room today, and I can tell you that phone is 20 years old and it still works fine, right? And then there were desk phones as well. So all kinds of phones that were sold through different telephony providers.
If I close my eyes and really think about it, I can probably hear the sound of a Polycom phone, like especially the internet over IP phone ringing. I think I still have that sound in my ears.
Yes. Yeah.
So what was a little bit of the background of the Plantronics acquisition then?
So Plantronics is perhaps most famous for the headsets that were given to the Apollo pilots. So starting with some of the latter Mercury missions, and for all of the Apollo missions, the headsets were actually made by Plantronics. So the very famous first transmission from the moon and Neil Armstrong was through a Plantronics headset. Plantronics also had different kinds of headsets that were used by airline pilots, control towers, and then just by Joe Schmoes. So ones that you would use at work or at a call center, or even for jogging or riding a Peloton, they sports headsets. So when the companies came together, it was really with the view that this was the end-to-end collaboration across all of the kinds of things that you would want to do in an office in whatever way you would want to communicate.
And when that combination happens, how long did you have to figure out, because oftentimes in that moment, it's like everyone's focused on what's the name going to be. Now, we know there's a lot of strategy and other work that has to happen even before the name, which then obviously happens before the identity. But how long did you have? How much pressure do you have? Did you have a seat at the top table as well to be able to set expectations and influence what needed to be done?
So we actually started talking about what's the name, what's the brand, who are we, while I was on vacation before the deal closed. So I was talking with my new CEO about it even before it really got underway, but the deal closed in July and we wanted to have our unveiling at the big collaboration trade show called Enterprise Connect, which was in March. So not a long time to get soup to nuts. And as with any branding, you know, there's the fun part, the creative part, the what does it look like? How do we bring this all together? And then there's the really less fun stuff about legal entities. And it's not just rolling the brand out and splashy ads, but you've got to think about physical plant. And we had signs on buildings, global companies. So everything had to be first inventoried. We didn't know, for example, we had a manufacturing facility in Mexico. None of us knew they wore uniforms. So we had to design uniforms as part of this. So it was pretty far reaching in a very short amount of time.
But even going back to then the actual then the creation development of the brand, even before the name, did you go through research? Was there a sort of brand positioning, brand platform exercise? Maybe take us under the hood in the process.
It was extremely fortunate when we announced that the deal was going to be done at Polycom. I had our annual brand tracker was about to go out. So we grabbed it back and were able to add some questions in. Plantronics similarly was about to do one. So we let them both run. We looked at both of them, and we were able to have very fresh, very accurate data on brand awareness of both Plantronics and Polycom. What did people know about them? What did they think about them? And it really informed early on how to think about the brand, because what we learned was both brands were very well known in their respective spaces. Both brands were very respected, but neither one of them had a particularly emotional connection. So people knew us, both of us, they liked us, but we weren't really sparking that emotional connection that drives the kind of loyalty we were looking for. And so that gave us a starting place for how to think about the new brand and really focus on injecting a lot of humanity into it.
And then how was that articulated then through a story? Was there like a core single-minded idea that represented the new brand truth?
It was really about making human connections. Because what we did with video at that time was still relatively new. And so highlighting the fact that your headsets or your phones or your video screens shouldn't get in the way of what you're trying to do, which is actually connect with other people. And so that really became the brand truth. And we wanted to move away from a couple of things that happen in anybody who was marketing collaboration hardware or software at the time. Was there would be a great, beautiful conference room showing happy, shiny people collaborating, right? And we wanted to move away from some of that hackneyed view of the way things work and to focus instead on the emotion of the connection, not the literal, like, okay, we're all working. And we were doing some early shoots and I had to keep going into the conference room because I would walk out and the team would make the guy take his phone out of his pocket and they were constantly going around cleaning the lipstick off the mug. And I'm like, no, this is real. We have to have real people here with real connection.
Yeah. Human means leaning into those imperfections as well. And then what about the decision then to go forward with, how do you arrive to the decision to move forward with Poly? And take us even into some of the conversations that must have been very interesting around the fact that you weren't going forward with a net new name. You were carrying the equity over from one of the core brands, but with a slight modification, but essentially killing the other brand that you said Neil Armstrong had initially communicated the moon landing?
It was a tough call. Initially, we had thought we would either go with Plantronics or Polycom. That was kind of, we were trying to, and there was a lot of emotion around that. And both companies had storied histories. Both companies had long tenured employees who felt very connected to their brands. And we were struggling with this. And I have to hand it to the agency that we worked with. It was Prophet at the time. The guy who was running the team with us said, "Have you thought about Poly?" And we were like, "Huh, wow." And then we started thinking about the many ways that we're helping people to connect and the many stories that both companies had. So we were able to really start to see how Poly, meaning many, kind of played across all of the pieces. And then as we translated that into the logo and the story, we were able to build this logo that was like a propeller that kind of leaned into the aviation past and present. And it started to become a very compelling and easy to tell story to employees. And that started to make the difference. We also leaned into legacy in terms of some of the colors we chose. So the Plantronics had an orange that they called Lava. Polycom was all about red. So we killed the red, kept the orange. And so we were bringing in pieces from both sides to really try to show that this was a union.
It's funny you tell the story of the orange, because one of my first ever projects was working on the AT&T acquisition of Singular. And it was very similar in the sense that we sort of killed the Singular brand. I still remember my brand strategy professor from business school calling me up going, "You've destroyed $12 billion of brand equity here." But yet explained to him what, A, the business strategy that we were moving more to this notion of bundling. So you needed to carry forward a single brand. But what really connected with me was a very similar strategy, which is, what are some of the equities that we can carry forward, not only to keep that brand alive, but as a way to tell that story to all the Singular employees so they still felt that sense of connection? Funnily enough, it was also an orange that was layered into the AT&T brand.
Yeah, orange is a personal favorite color of mine, but it can be hard to do right.
Why is it a favorite?
I just find it incredibly optimistic. And I would be lying if I didn't also say that a little bit of a kind of Hermes orange. And there you go.
They probably don't call it Hermes orange, do they? We probably need to look into that. It probably has a different...
Yeah, it's probably got something much more French.
So did you find that in reality that was able to appease some of the Plantronics people? Because even though you didn't go with the Polycom name, that association is much closer tied in to Poly.
Yeah. So when we rolled everything out, the Polycom people who were unhappy and the Plantronics people who were unhappy with the new brand and style and everything were roughly equal. So I felt that that was a success. We've managed to irritate, you know, both sides. But one of the things that was really, really important and something that anytime you're doing a major rebrand is HR needs to be your best friend. So our CHRO and I were like arm in arm for months leading to the rollout, because part of what we were also trying to do was to build that new company culture and to bring some of the things that were best about Plantronics and some of the things that were best about Polycom, bring those together. And so the rollout of the brand incorporated a lot of, we built internal champions who got sneak peeks and educated them. And so people around the world were there to be brand champions and to help explain things. And we had a big party rollout and special events and contests internally for people to help start to celebrate and make people aware. And I would say that if we hadn't done that, it could easily have been a disaster.
Talk a bit about the logo process, because I understand that was very interesting.
So the logo we sweated over. So it's kind of three P's together. So Polycom, Plantronics, and then Poly. And it looks like a propeller We worked on it forever. And just about when we were rolling it out, somebody said, hey, that kind of looks like this logo on this headset manufacturer over here. So we had registered for trademarks. We'd done all the filings. We'd done all the searches, but other companies' headset had not filed anything. It was not publicly available. It was not for sale. So we knew nothing about it.
All right. It's not like it wasn't in any way a lapse as part of the process of doing the competitive due diligence. It was one of those moments where something was being almost developed in parallel.
Right. And they weren't identical. They were frighteningly similar. But there was this moment of panic. Like, because the first thing was like, did somebody steal it? Right. Or did we not know that we? So there's all that kind of flurry. But then there's also the realization that there are, I think, maybe 4 logos in the world, and they just go in endless variations. So if you want to do things with the letter P, there's only so many things you can do with, and they're going to start looking similar. So the unfortunate part, of course, were the employees who were like, oh, what, you couldn't be bothered to do a reverse Google search? I'm like, yes, we could be bothered. And in fact, we did. But you can only say that so much before you start sounding defensive. So we shouldered on. We went with it. There was legal activity. It was all settled. It's all resolved. Everybody's happy. And the logo, we'll see how long it lives. Poly, since I left, has been acquired by Hewlett-Packard, who also have a pretty storied logo. And so I don't know how long my work will still live.
So what are your big learnings as you think about what that experience brought you in terms of logos? You mentioned this notion of there just being 4 logos. How did you sort of get to that?
So you've got round logos, you've got square logos. So anything that is not a discrete object, if your logo is a head of a dog or whatever, right? But if you're making shapes, there's only so many shapes. And so what I think was important and the learning was, it wasn't a random shape that we chose. It had meaning, and we had spent so much time building that meaning into it. It made it much easier for us to defend, if you will, our logo, because we could tell the story of all of the things that it stood for. So I think it's important not to choose something just because you like, oh, it's cool looking. Well, that's not going to help you should something come up.
So it sounds like you really lent into this idea of there's a real opportunity to having a story for what an expression represents that almost become, you need to tell, right? That you extract it from there. Oftentimes I find that that's used a lot as part of a launch, but over time it tends to then dissipate. Like new employees that join in the convening years don't know about that story. It just seems to get lost.
Yeah, at Poly, we referred to the logo as the propeller.
So giving it a name is a way
And the propeller is part of the story. When we rebranded Omnitrax, which has now been sold and is part of Solera, and so you can't go look at what I'm talking about, but rebranded it as an O for Omnitrax, but it also resembled both a steering wheel and a tire. And we called it the steering wheel because part of what Omnitrax was really focused on was the transportation and trucking industries, which is all about getting you where you need to go safely and getting the goods where they need to go safely. And so the steering wheel was part of that story of who we were as a company.
I mean, one of the things that we hear a lot that branding professionals have struggled with sometimes is being able to have a conversation with an executive about brand, like someone who's been in a CMO role. Can you take us behind the closed doors of some of those conversations with a CEO, a CFO, and some of the experiences and learnings that you've had? And you can even include some examples where things didn't go, because that's where you get some of the great learnings.
Yeah, I think the first thing is that I'm a very passionate believer that good brand does not come out of committee, and it certainly doesn't come out of consensus. I think that you have to be clear on what you're trying to accomplish, and you also have to kind of be clear on the rules of the game, who actually gets a vote before you start, or you can find yourself in very murky surroundings because brand, like almost everything else in marketing, everybody can see. And so everybody's an expert, right? So knowing who is going to be a player and knowing what they care about and figuring out how to have influence is a good thing to have on upfront. And then when we were rebranding OmniTrax, put it out in front of the executive committee and actually purple. We really think it's more indigo. And they're like, purple? Can we be, guys, is purple a color? We can be purple? Oh my word, I had not anticipated that. I had, thank you, Ray Greer, my CEO at the time, said, it looks great, we're going with it. And so all of the purple chatter went away, although the rest of the executive team did make a point of sending me emails in purple fonts and really diving into the purpleness. But you have to be both confident in your convictions and you need to know why something is a good idea. So part of the reason at OmniTrax that we did go with that indigo purple was because it had great contrast against the green that we used as for the logo. So it had a very rich digital footprint that was clear and scaled well. So I could explain that it was not just a random choice. It was chosen, in fact, from laws of complementary colors and what will render well digitally as well as in print and a whole host of other issues. So I think the most important thing when you're having those closed door discussions is you need to be able to be convincing. It's just like first rule of CMOhood is numbers are the language of the boardroom. So you don't walk in to show pretty pictures. You walk in to show how you're driving growth and you're retaining customers and you're driving revenue. And then you have the permission to show the really cool stuff that you're doing, right? And I think with brand, you have to be able to speak in the whys and why it matters as much as you do on the elements of what plays out.
Because one of the harder things about brand is the intangibility in some ways, where these days there's so much about digital marketing where you can drive direct attribution and show that linear connection. And with brand, you need to do more of a dance, right? You need to sort of show the linkages and connections. From your experience, what have been the way that you've either story told through brand to be able to connect it to business outcomes or the sorts of quantifiable numbers that you've used to make the case?
Yeah, I mean, there. If you have NPS, as we did at Microsoft and at HP, you've got kind of a clear connection to what people think about the company and how they recommend. But I actually think one of the most interesting ways to think about and measure brand is to use it as a yardstick for product development. So, which is something that we were doing at Poly. Once we'd done the brand, we were like, okay, so is the sound quality or is the noise canceling on this headset, does it meet our bar? Does it meet the Poly bar? Because this is what we know we stand for people. And so if it's not meeting that bar, we shouldn't do it. And I think that is a way to get people across the boardroom to buy into the notion of brand, because now you're using it as a means to get product aligned. It's a means to say, okay, well, is that the kind of customer service people would expect from our brand? Or is that the kind of sales approach people would expect? And then you've got something that is much more than an amorphous, but it's actually something that people live and breathe every day. And that becomes very powerful.
You talked earlier when we were talking about when you were telling the story of understanding what's important to people. And it reminded me of there's a great sort of Japanese business concept that's called Nemawashi, which is this sort of core idea of laying the groundwork. So they say that when you're doing business in Japan, every meeting that you walk into should be a formality because everyone already knows what you're asking for, what decision's going to be made. It sounds like you apply a bit of that in executive discussions. How do you actually go about doing that?
So one of the most valuable executive training that I ever had was when I was at Microsoft, and it was one of these two-day deep dives, and it was about how to influence the other players. And instead of thinking about, well, how do I influence finance? Finance is not a monolithic thing. It's really, how do I influence Chuck in finance that matters, because Chuck may be worrying about different things than Diane in finance. And so I think it comes down to understanding your stakeholders as individuals, understanding what they care about and what they don't care about. And that, I think, is effective management. I don't know that it's specific to brand or to sales or to any particular discipline, but it's really about understanding what people are worried about and how to demonstrate to them that what you're doing is going to make things easier for them in their roles.
Is there a way to get that information? Because sometimes if you just ask the question very directly, what do you mean? And I don't want to tell you exactly what my worries are.
I think there's certainly, you know, what your colleagues' metrics are. So their measures of success are on the business side, and then using your eyes and ears to determine a little bit more about what things tend to set them off. And I think that's emotional intelligence right there.
You went from working with some incredible, very well-known corporate brands with a lot of infrastructure, a lot more resources, and you've gone into a very exciting industry that's serving electric vehicles. Before we talk about a bit more about the industry, how different has it and have you had to adapt in thinking about brand at a sort of founder-led, smaller startup organization compared to being at the likes of Poly? Like, have you had to adjust?
How have I not had to adjust? I think it would be still the same discipline, but going from companies with 100,000 people to a company with 100 people has certainly been a big change. I think the founder is no longer with the company, but many of the people who were there at the company's founding, and the company is Y-Tricity, was spun out of MIT. And Y-Tricity, wireless electricity. So I cheerfully tell anybody that had I been with the company when it was founded, it would not be named Y-Tricity, both from a brand perspective and just kind of dorky, but is a hard word to say. We get Witricity, with Y-Trust, like all kinds of variations. It doesn't particularly localize well, but what we're doing is really, really cool. And so coming in, there had not been a CMO prior to my arrival. So it's really been building a discipline and a path from scratch, which has been very exciting and as hands-on as I've been since I started in marketing a long time ago.
I think there's a lot of people who are going to be listening. Let me put it another way. Out of the people who are going to be listening, I think a lot of them are going to be very interested in this category, whether it's 2 people or 20 people or 2,000 people in electric vehicles. Talk a bit about how Y-Tricity is transforming the game as we would traditionally think about vehicle charging.
Right. So really one of the number one objections to EVs, general case in the U.S., is the hassle of charging. People worry about finding a charger, that they worry about the range, they worry that they're unsafe in a public charger, they worry they're going to lose their charger, or they're going to forget to plug in, somebody else can plug in. All of these issues kind of surround, and so the hassle of charging is a big deal. And we make it easy because all you do is park. And you park over a pad that is about the size of a large pizza box on the ground or installed in ground so it can be level with the surface of the street. And that's it. You just park. So it charges wirelessly over that air gap. And the piece that always boggles people's minds is that it is just as efficient as the plug. So the first thing people will say is, well, it's got to be inefficient because what your phone charger is not as fast as plugging it in. It's a different technology. And it is just as efficient. And it's pretty magical. When I get to go to our HQ, we have a couple of vehicles there that we've upgraded to support wireless charging. And that becomes the vehicle that you drive while you're in town. And you get to the office and you park and you come out at the end of the day and you've got a full battery. It's just pretty amazing.
It seems like such a no-brainer. Why isn't this everywhere? And why, when it comes to then adding additional charging, that they're still adding the traditional? Why? That's something that still boggles my mind a bit.
I think there's a couple of different answers. So I'll start with the fact that automakers are risk averse, right? It's a vehicle that needs to be safe. It needs to be proven. And until just a few years ago, it wasn't entirely clear how broadly electric vehicles were going to take off. And so a lot of the automakers are kind of like, wait and see. You know, they spend a fair amount of the time looking over their shoulder, seeing what the other guys are doing and trying to figure out. One of the keys to get over that hesitancy was to have a standard. And so Witricity worked for the better part of a decade with the Society of Automotive Engineers to set the standard. So that standard was ratified in 2020. And as we speak here in April of 23, that ratification in 2020 in auto years was like yesterday. So they're all working on it. And we have seen vehicles come to market in Asia that have wireless charging from the factory. We have done some aftermarket upgrades and will continue to do that and partnering with others to do that as well. The second thing about charging is human nature, where anything that is new, we interpret right through what we already know. And so we know how to put a plug in the car to fill it with gas. And so it's human nature to default to an idiom that we've already understood. When you think about it, the reason you go to a gas station to fill your car is because gas is noxious, flammable, and very dangerous. So you don't want that in your garage or your driveway, right? Electricity is in your garage and your driveway and at the mall and really everywhere you go in settled environment, electricity is now there. So why do you make it a chore to go someplace? So as people kind of get over that, oh, I don't have to go to a gas station anymore, then we start getting people to go, oh, well, I can bring wireless charging really any place that I'm already parked. Cars are parked 95% of the time. I don't need a plug. Right? So we're seeing people go through the cycle, and people who have been early adopters of electric vehicles will tell you one of the things they wish people knew was you really don't have to go to a gas station or a charging station very much. Now, of course, exceptions are for people who are going long distances. You need a fast charger there. Or for people who don't have a dedicated parking space, then you need public parking infrastructure, but it doesn't have to be a plug.
Right. So people are obsessed still with this notion of fast charging as opposed to...
Yeah. And if you want to use a gas station model, it has to be fast. But if you filled your car with electrons as quickly as you fill your car with gas, that's like the power of 40 homes in upstate New York that you're putting in your car in 5 minutes. That's ridiculous. That's a huge amount of energy.
Yeah, I always equated, when you first told me about this, that the experience that Witricity is bringing to car charging to me was almost like, what is the Uberification of what Uber did to taxis? Just the notion of I've arrived, I can just get out the car and leave, as right. opposed to having to stop for a moment, that friction point of then having to pay the cab driver. It's the same, like I don't have to come in and actually charge it. I park and you park and go.
So we in our family have been driving electric cars since 2014. So we've been after it for a while. And last week, I forgot to plug in the car before we went to bed. Next morning, my husband is like, kind of had places to go today. And I was like, yeah. So as soon as I can get the Witricity kit in my house, that problem will go away.
Amy, let's finish with the wisdom round. So a couple of sort of rapid fire questions. What advice would you have loved to have given a younger Amy? I was going to say 30-year-old Amy, but that would have been just 5 years ago. So I was going to say a younger Amy.
I think that have the courage of your convictions, but know why you are convicted. It's not enough for you to believe it to be so, but you need to know the reasons why you believe it, because then you're much more able to stand up for whether it's your work or your beliefs or your ideas, if you can express them intelligently to people with a justification. That would be the first one. And the second one would be get rid of that, are you coming to dinner today? Ending at the end of your sentence, much younger in your career.
What's the right way to say that?
That'd be, are you coming to dinner?
Is it a California reference? I'm trying to understand exactly what the reference is.
It's something that is endemic in women in particular, okay. Where we do these little things to kind of not be offensive and go take up space. It's okay.
Got it. What would you describe as being like your core leadership principles?
I am a big believer in team And as a leader, I try to be player coach. My preference is for me to be able to tell my leaders, this is where we're going. This is why we're going there. This is your role. Now you do it, but you have to give people the why. Some people will blindly do whatever you say, but you're going to get a lot more creative and collaborative engagement with your team if you tell them why you want them to do something, not necessarily how to do it.
What's the best feedback you've ever been given?
Oh, wow. It was great to hear somebody tell me, we know you're smart, but that's not enough, right? We need the results.
Where do you go for learnings to stay up to speed with what's going on in marketing and business?
I read everything. My only challenge is I often can't remember where I read it. You know, it could have been in Harvard Business Review. It could have been in Vogue. It could have been in some random marketing newsletter that I get in my inbox, but I just read everything. And I think I am grateful as I'll get out for my one superpower, which is that I read extraordinarily quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I can consume vast amounts. I get very impatient if I have to watch video to learn something, because I read it three times as fast as you could say it to me.
Any secrets that you have around getting the best of your agency partners?
And it comes down to the brief. I think more than anything else, if you're working with an agency and you have not done the hard work of getting the brief good and tight, you're going to be either lucky or disappointed.
I'll give a big shout out to someone who I read a lot, and that's a Mark Ritson, who writes for Marketing Week in the UK. And this is one of his biggest bugbears. There was a study done last year that was called Better Briefs, where they asked 100 or so agency people and 100 or so client side. And they asked the client side people, how good do you think you are at writing briefs? And they asked the agency people, how good do you think the clients are at asking briefs? And there's this huge gap. How well? I think something like 70% of clients think they're excellent at writing briefs.
Wow.
And the number of agencies, something like 7% of agencies said that they get good briefs from clients.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. And in fact, one of my favorite games to play when I watch ads on TV that I don't understand is, I would love to see the brief on that.
Wonderful. Amy, thank you so much. It's been so much fun having this conversation. Really, really insightful as well.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. And always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Amy. That was awesome. That was great.
It just
felt like one of our conversations. That's what I loved about it. It just felt like we were talking. It didn't even feel like it was being recorded.
That's great. And I think I learned something every time I do something like this. And Mark, what's his name?
Mark Ritson. And I'll send you this specific article. It is the one thing I read every week. It's his column on Marketing Week. Because not only is he very smart, I think he's the ideal marketer because he's a bit of a curmudgeon and he's a skeptic. And I think that's because in marketing, we already have a natural tendency to want to, right? We're thinking about selling things and telling the positive side of it. And there's something, I think, magical about coming in as a skeptic and calling BS on everything as a marketer.
So have you read Gobbledy? Jared Blank is the author. He basically writes a weekly newsletter that makes fun of tech business to business marketing, and it is hysterical.
I'll look forward to seeing that.
My favorites are when he will pull something verbatim from the Gartner website, and it's awesome. Although I do live in fear that one of the days something I wrote, it's going to show up in his column as just being an utter mangle of senseless words. So we now put things through the, would Jared make fun of this? Okay, we're good.
I have to read you a quote from the Better Briefs thing here that I had, because his writing is also very entertaining. He always has a bit of a conflict with Marketing Week because he curses a lot in his writing, which is just another thing that I love. He talks about that the horrors of marketers' strategic bankruptcy was revealed by this Better Briefs.
Oh, wow.
Study. Yeah. I mean, he's savage.
Strategic bankruptcy.
Yeah, he got strategic bankruptcy. And what's interesting is he has been, like everyone, probably me included, like the whole AI ChatGPT revolution and the impact for marketers. And he's calling on this because what he's saying is, like, look, first marketers need to understand strategy first, because this is just going to be another tactical thing.
Right.
His point, I think, that is much more interesting with ChatGPT is how it's impacting after more than a decade or so, it's the one thing that's going to threaten Google's dominance of search. And his main point there is it's not necessarily that it's going to make search better. It's the pure perception that people now have that AI equals better search, and therefore they're now going to be willing to even look at Bing.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm fascinated by the whole ChatGPT and I spent way, way too much time with DALL-E making images over the holidays. I have my golden doodles in virtually every type of painting you can imagine.
And your own?
No. I just...
Right, just a random one. Okay. Could now upload your photo as well. So this is what he says. 2/3 of big brand briefs are unclear about who they are targeting. More than half the client briefs delivered last year had no clear objectives. So he said, we need to put down the toys like AR because they are toys. He said, partly because they are toys and partly because while we are about with them, the basic building blocks of what we should be doing sit jumbled and unassembled on the floor of the playpen all around us. I just love that.
Okay, he's on my list now.
Yeah.
That's great.
And he's very data-driven. Like, he's an academic, so a lot of his thinking is, it's not premised on Byron Sharp's work, but he'll discuss it and debate it a lot. So a bit overly CPG focused.
Yeah.
But it's still, I always learn something from his stuff.
Very cool.
I will let you go. Thank you. It was lovely to catch up. And I loved it when we would just catch up every quarter. So we'd love to carry on doing that.
Likewise.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.